Chief Judge Bonnie Bull of the Nevada Court of Appeals, and with me today in Las Vegas is Judge Michael Gibbons and Judge Deborah Westbrook. This is the date and time set for oral argument in case number 89623 in the matter of in re guardianship of ALRQ, ARW, and AMW, minor protected persons. Participating in Las Vegas, we have Attorney Joseph Reynolds on behalf of appellants Kelly and Edward Ruckel, and we have Attorney Rohi Mohas on behalf of respondents, the minor protected children, and Attorney Kurt Smith on behalf of respondents, Sarah, is it Qtop? And I don't believe we have anyone else with us at council table today. Each side is entitled to 15 minutes of argument. Mr. Reynolds, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal? Very good. And Mr. Moss and Mr. Smith, you have 15 minutes and you will need to decide how you will be dividing your time. And if you are aware of that now, you can let us know or just handle it among between yourselves.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Mr. Reynolds, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Judge Bulla, members of the court. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Joe Reynolds, and I'm here on behalf of appellants Kelly and Edward Ruckel. The Ruckels love their granddaughters dearly. All they want and all they have ever wanted is what is in the girls' best interests and for them to be in a safe, nurturing, and stable home. And this is why they asked this court for relief today. On January 14th, 2022, the district court issued a written order appointing the Ruckels guardians of their three minor granddaughters, ages 14, 13, and 11 at the time. This was done after a two-day evidentiary hearing where eight witnesses testified, numerous documents and photographs were admitted into evidence. In its written order, the district court found that based on clear and convincing evidence, the Ruckels were suitable guardians for their granddaughters. The Ruckels had been the stable adults and caregivers throughout their granddaughters' lives. Their older sister was formally adopted by the Ruckels with Ms. Qtop's consent. And the Ruckels had been appointed temporary guardians of the girls for a period of time previously with Ms. Qtop's consent. And in 2018, Ms. Qtop left the girls with the Ruckels for what was supposed to be an extended weekend. She did not come back for years, and the Ruckels, wanting permanency to the relationship, petitioned the district court for guardianship. The district court, in its order, specifically found that it was in the girls' best interests that the guardianship be awarded. But the district court also found in its order that respondent Ms. Qtop, the girls' biological mother, has throughout the girls' lives, and I quote, failed to provide them with food, shelter, clothing, education, or general welfare. She is engaged in sustained abuse of the protected minors, forcing them to live in unsanitary conditions without soap, towels, or clean clothing, engaged in emotional manipulation, and allowed them to be physically and emotionally abused by others who lived with them. The district court further found that Ms. Qtop failed to provide for the girls' most basic needs, and Ms. Qtop presented a significant safety risk to the girls. Fast forward 2.5 years later, the district court's order was undone in a 7-minute hearing by a new district court judge on July 25th, 2024. The Ruckels' guardianship over their minor granddaughters was terminated. The girls and all their belongings were ordered to be returned to Ms. Qtop within 3 days at a truck stop on Blue Diamond Highway. No notice was given to the Ruckels that the district court intended to terminate the guardianship or would even be discussing it at the July hearing. Ms. Qtop had only filed a petition to terminate the guardianship the day before the hearing was held. No evidence was admitted, no testimony was heard, no argument was even allowed by the Ruckels counsel at the time. The district court did not issue a written order until 10 weeks later. In the order, it cited no law, no clear and convincing evidence standard. Reports the district court relied on by Dr. Stephanie Holland were not in the record. And importantly, most importantly, no best interest of the child findings were made in the written order. What occurred here violated the most basic tenets of due process in Nevada law governing guardianship over protected minors. The district court abused its discretion, and the Ruckels request this court, at a minimum, reverse and remand the order for a full evidentiary hearing. This case is highly analogous to a recent published Nevada Supreme Court opinion in the matter of guardianship of DMF, which is a 2023 opinion that's cited throughout our opening and reply brief. There, the Nevada Supreme Court held that a grandmother who was appointed guardian of her minor grandchild had protected due process rights and was entitled to advance notice and a full and fair hearing supported by factual evidence before a guardianship could be terminated. The most basic tenets of due process: notice and opportunity to be heard. Notice is defined as that which is reasonably calculated to give clear indication and apprised a party of a pending action, and an opportunity to have meaningful objections. Here, there was no notice provided to the Ruckels that the district court intended to terminate their guardianship, let alone discuss terminating it at the July 25th, 2024 hearing. This violated constitutional due process. It also violated statutory provisions in NRS 159A-1855. The only notice the Ruckels had was Ms. Kotob's petition filed the day before the hearing.
Mr. Reynolds, let me just ask this question then. Did the Ruckels have notice of the petition that was filed the day before the hearing that Mom filed?
Yes, they did receive it the day before the hearing.
And did the Ruckels have actually the opportunity to review Dr. Holland's report? Is there any place in the record that indicates that they were provided with the report and had the opportunity to review it?
There's nothing in the record, Your Honor. I was brought in as appellate counsel. I know that that report is not in the record. It is cited to, but it is not in the district court record.
And I understand you're just appellate counsel here, but is there any understanding that you have from a review of the record that an effort was made to attach that document to the record on appeal, even if it was under seal?
I have not seen it, Your Honor. And again, I've looked for it, and I would note that respondents in their answering brief acknowledge that Dr. Holland's reports that were relied on by the district court are not in the record. And that is also noted in our reply brief as well.
How do you respond to the respondent's argument that the Ruckels were on notice that they were not complying with the duties provided by the court order and complying with the requirements, of reunification and the orders, to meet with Dr. Holland and comply? Your colleagues on the other side of the bench here take the position that provided notice that the removal of the guardian could occur sua sponte under 159A-185 and under the Jones decision. Why is this case not like Jones?
Sure, Judge Westbrook. A couple answers to your question. First of all, this case is distinguishable from Jones. Jones involved adult guardianships, not minor guardianships. And in Jones, there was a full evidentiary hearing held. 5 witnesses testified in the Jones case.
Right. I'm talking about notice, not about the opportunity to respond, but on the notice issue of the information that was provided.
Sure, certainly, Judge Westbrook. In Jones, there were multiple requests made in that case for the termination of the guardianship prior to it being ordered. Hearings regarding reunification therapy, which the district court originally rejected and denied that request when it was first made by Ms. Kotob, is a different conversation than termination of the full guardianship. And before the district court would properly be allowed to do that, the Ruckels were entitled to an evidentiary hearing, where they could present argument, where they could rebut any allegations made against them. And that evidentiary hearing is absent in the record in this case. Again, there is no evidence in the record. Dr. Holland's reports are not in the record. And even if they were, they are hearsay. And at a minimum, the Ruckels should be allowed an opportunity to cross-examine Dr. Holland or present rebuttal evidence. Dr. Holland didn't testify. The girls didn't testify. The Ruckels didn't testify. Ms. Kotob didn't testify. And even when the Ruckels counsel stood up.
Are you arguing procedural due process, substantive due process, or both? You mentioned already notice and opportunity to be heard. What about a liberty interest? Do the Ruckels, as appointed guardians, have a liberty interest, a constitutional interest? And how does that compare to a parent's liberty interest to parent their own children?
Yes, Judge Gibbons. The Nevada Supreme Court specifically addressed this issue in the DMF 2023 opinion and recognized that of an appointed guardian, especially where it's a family member. I know I'm going to go over a few minutes of my rebuttal if I can answer your question, has a protected liberty interest.
How does that compare to the parent's interest, though? Because there's possible tension between their interests, and parents' interests usually prevail if you go back to the U.S. Supreme Court case that Troxell that dealt with grandparent visitation.
Yes, Judge Gibbons, the Supreme Court stopped slightly short of DMF in saying it was identical, but did say it was akin. And especially in this case, we are also talking about a biological grandmother of the girls. So it is a family, and it is a protected liberty interest. And to answer your question, both substantive due process as well as procedural due process in this case. And I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the court, Roy Moss on behalf of the minors as CAP attorney. My office was also not involved during the underlying case, and we were brought on as appellate counsel, but we've had an opportunity to present the court with our position. The minors take the position here that this has been a slow moving train towards reunification. Appellants would like to gloss over what happened between 2021 and 2024 when that reunification came to fruition, but we can't just gloss over that. In that regard, this case is more akin to Jones than it is to DMF. In DMF, the court notes that there weren't there, aside from the court, there was no one seeking to terminate the guardianship. Whereas here you have a parent whose parental rights were never terminated, but guardianship was provided to the mother, the grandmother. As a housekeeping matter, I'm reminded that one of my clients, ALRQ, is now no longer a minor, and so even though it's housekeeping, the appeal arguably is moot as to her, and I think the parties are in agreement on that.
How old are ARW and AMW right now?
17 and 15, I believe.
Okay. Do you agree that the Ruckels, as guardians, had a due process right to notice and an opportunity to be heard prior to termination of their guardianship?
We do. We don't take issue with that.
Okay.
The counsel for the mother will discuss the distinction between termination and removal of a guardian that the court believes is not acting in the best interest of the children. But we've never taken the position that there is no due process rights. I think Jones and DMF are clear on that.
Okay. In your view, did the court terminate the Ruckels guardianship sua sponte, or did the court do it in response to Sarah's petition?
We think that the petition had little to do with it. By that time, we believe that the decision was already made, that the train had reached the station. that there was a cumulative effort to get reunification with the mother, who was fighting for that reunification after losing guardianship of the children. And that's the main focus of the argument that the minors take, that those 2.5 years cannot be glossed over. And the record with regards to those 2.5 years are clear. By the time March of 2022 came along, it was the mother's third petition to seek reunification therapy and start down this path of getting guardianship back of her children.
Did she in any of those petitions for reunification expressly ask the court to consider removing the respondents as guardians?
I don't think that there was an express request. There was concerns raised with regards to the well-being of the children. And so the court took methodical steps to reach reunification. First, the court didn't necessarily agree. They said, well, we need an assessment to determine whether or not reunification therapy even makes sense. And that's why Mr. Ponza was hired. And eventually, after a year later and dragging it out, there was that recommendation by the court.
Because in Jones, I think the distinction that opposing counsel brought up was after the respondents had expressly asked the court to consider removing the guardians, that was, you know, maybe a different form of notice to the guardians that, gosh, you know, parents are seeking to terminate that guardianship. But whereas in this case, I don't know, there was efforts to reunify, which might be somewhat distinguishable from efforts to terminate or remove guardians.
Look, Judge, I think the focus was not on removal of the guardians early on, but eventually it became the focus of the efforts, especially in December of 2023, when Dr. Holland, the neutral therapist, comes forward and says that the guardians are obstructing this path moving forward. From that point, there's a statewide guardianship rule 5 hearing, and the Ruckels should have been at notice, and arguably they were participating in the process, because this is the first time that the record shows us that the Ruckels represent to the court that things are going well with regards to the visitation with the mother, with regards to the therapy. Nonetheless, they take the opportunity at that time to block Mr. Ponzo from further involvement, to block Dr. Holland. And so those can only be seen as efforts to stop the train, stop the reunification, and keep possession of the guardian of the minor children.
Was removal or termination discussed at the Rule 5 hearing?
I can't answer that, but counsel's prepared to address that in the...
So what would be the harm if the case was remanded to the district court to allow the guardians the opportunity to review Dr. Holland's report and to perhaps challenge it if required, or at least to look at the report to make the determination of whether they would challenge it or not? And why wouldn't that be important, since the guardians did not have the opportunity to do that at the time of the hearing when the guardianship was essentially revoked?
Our knee-jerk reaction to that is to say more due process is always beneficial, but it's not in a vacuum here. The children would be dragged through additional evidentiary hearings, which both sides agree have been harmful to them, and more scrutiny between the parties. That takes us to the focus of May of 2024. When Dr. Holland's report, and my understanding is that it's distributed to all parties and left side filed with the court, which counsel, who is much more familiar with family law, can address to this court. But at that point, that was the red flag. They had an opportunity to challenge the report, as they've done in the past with regards to anything that Dr. Holland presented to the court, and they chose not to.
Well, in this case, there really wasn't sufficient time, was there? Didn't the court at the time of the hearing already announce, I've already made up my mind, essentially, I'm going to terminate this guardianship, and didn't give the guardians the opportunity to even acknowledge that they had received the report or even acknowledge that they had questions or concerns about the report, nor did they have the opportunity to hire their own expert to take a look at the report. None of that occurred here. The decision was made before they even had the hearing on the day at issue. Is there support for that type of a decision in either the statute or the case law?
Yes, Judge, I'll answer that question, then I'll remit the time. If we just look at the hearing transcript from July 25th, it almost seems like whiplash, but that's not the case. On July 13th, the court issued an order expressing what essentially was the path that the court was taking. And a month and a half or a month prior to that, in May of 2020, or the parties received the report. So that was another opportunity. It's the cumulative nature of those three different separate items that provides even additional notice. And with that,
is there support in the record that the parties did receive the report, as you indicate?
Nothing in the record, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Your Honor, Attorney Kurt Smith on behalf of the natural mother, Sarah Qutob. Again, I believe that this is much more of a removal case than it is a termination case. I believe that the court has plenary power to do a removal in this case pursuant to NRS 159A.185. In fact, the express language of NRS 159A.185 says that the court may remove a guardian if the court finds that certain aspects or certain harms are being had with regard to the guardian. Here, we talked about subsection E, where the guardians negligently failed to perform their duties as a guardian, which cause harm to the minor children. Now, in the record, we talked about and things were discussed with regard to the children not going to school, the children not being up to their grade level, and that the Dr. Holland was recommending an educational assessment that the guardians over and over refused to participate in.
But don't the guardians still have to have some opportunity of notice and to be heard? I mean, even under NRS 159.1855, which deals with direction a court may take, there still has to be some sort of notice or citation given to the guardians to say, hey, you know, you're subject to removal.
That's if the removal petition is filed by a third party. But here, this is a judicial sua sponte removal based upon the actions of the guardian.
Isn't that what happened in Jones? Jones was
exactly what happened.
Okay. So, but in Jones, I think that the distinction was the court actually issued some orders that contained language indicating that it had the power to remove. Where, so for instance, we have a July 13th order, which, you know, it was mentioned, expressed the path that the court was taking. Anywhere in that July 13th order, did the court say, hey guys, just so you know, on the 25th, when we have this hearing, I'm considering removing you as guardians?
Not only do I think that didn't happen, I don't think it was required to happen. Now, the court expressed over and over its dissatisfaction with the way that the guardianship was going and with the obstruction that the guardians had put into place. Unlike these other two gentlemen, I was there during the guardianship proceedings. I attended most of those hearings, and the court was very dissatisfied with regard to the actions of the guardians.
Is it sufficient, though, for the court to make the determination just based solely on the ex parte letter from Dr. Holland without hearing from the guardians or taking some evidence? You know, how was it appropriate for the court to just conclude that, you know, I agree with this one side without hearing any evidence from the other side?
Again,
how does that comport with due process?
A three-year proceeding that we went through where the reunification with the natural mother was blocked at every step of the way. It was asked for a reunification, and what eventually got ordered was a process to see if reunification was even appropriate. after a year and a half of that, and it was determined that, then we went to Dr. Holland and went and started to do the reunification, and they were blocked at every step of the way. Now, in Ray Jones, it's the same issues. There's issues with regard to compliance with the court's orders, with regard to the court's procedure, and the removal was made.
But there was an evidentiary hearing with five witnesses who testified in Jones.
Okay. How about Deegan v. Deegan? In Deegan v. Deegan, which is a minor guardianship, and we are going back a ways, okay, but in the case of Deegan, there was absolutely no removal or no evidentiary hearing. It was simply a removal based on the failure of the guardian to provide the required reports.
Mr. Smith, where are the findings in the district court order that justifies that?
The court found that removal was appropriate based on the obstruction of the guardians.
That order was really short.
It was a very short order, I will admit that. And had I been the judge at the time, maybe I would have done something different. But here, again,
Was there anything about an emergency where the court had to act so precipitously?
The educational issues were severe, Your Honor, I think that was appropriate. But again, I think there's a parallel process here that the court needs to be looking at, because while we're in an NRS 159A posture, this could very well have been an NRS 4.5B, the juvenile court process. Now, in the juvenile process, where after there is removal, 45, I'm getting them mixed up, but in the juvenile process, the Department of Family Services is appointed as the custodian of the parties, and then they turn around and appoint a placement option. That placement is removable at any time. There's no evidentiary hearing required. If the Department of Family Services feels there's something wrong with the placement, they will remove that, and they'll inform the judge of that later. Here, in the parallel process on the civil side, where there's no governmental intervention but the judge, it's the judge that holds that ability. And the judge can make that decision to remove a guardian or a placement at any time.
Your client, though, did agree to the initial guardianship, right?
And
she was not opposed to her biological parent.
I would love to say yes. That's not true. There was an evidentiary hearing that she opposed.
Have that information in our record?
The contested underlying hearing? I'm sorry. Maybe
yes, the contested underlying hearing, the one that happened, I think it was it 2018?
Yes, 2018 to 2020, somewhere in there. And that's what my esteemed counsel, a colleague, would like the court to focus on, is the trial that showed that mom was unfit. But that's not where we are at the removal.
My only question was, do we have that information in the record before us or not?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Can I ask one final question?
Please.
So do you also agree that the Ruckles, as guardians, had a due process right to notice and an opportunity to be heard prior to termination? Or do you believe they don't have that constitutional right because they're just guardians?
I believe that they don't have that right because they are guardians. But even if the court found that they did have that right, the multiplicity of hearings and the dissatisfaction of the court expressed at every hearing was plenty of knowledge, just like in Jones, that removal was on the table, even if termination was not. Now, the court did reference in its final order, I am terminating the guardianship. But the reality is that what I believe the court should have said, and it did say kind of at the end, is that I'm removing the Ruckles as guardians, but that's a harmless error. And this, under the harmless error doctrine, if it's an error that doesn't affect the outcome of the case, then the court can overlook that and not have that be something that the court relies on to overturn the district court's decision.
I understand that you were in the proceedings below. Is there any evidence you can point to in the record that the Ruckles did have the report from Dr. Holland early on and had the opportunity to review it and challenge it in advance of the motion to essentially terminate the guardianship that was filed
before
the hearing?
There were actually two writings. My apologies for interrupting. There are actually two writings from Dr. Holland, a letter to the to the court that was distributed months in advance, and then the final report, which was distributed right before the hearing. But again, it was the overarching sense of this case as the court went through and heard over and over again about the obstruction.
But she's asking if you actually, if the other side had the document.
Yes, they did.
Okay.
We all had it. Yes.
Okay, that's the question.
How come we don't? Part of the record.
I don't know, Your Honor. I apologize. I wish I was the guy that put the exhibits together for the court and the record, and it was a left-side filed confidential document. I know it should have been probably delivered to the court, but in those types of situations, number one, I do believe it was the petitioner's responsibility to provide that to the court, and to the extent that it did not, this court routinely relies on the decision of the underlying the court below to say that it was their responsibility to do so, and they didn't.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes, sir.
Just as a side issue, what's the legal authority for the reunification process that could then be used to say, oh, it wasn't followed, so therefore the guardians should be removed?
Well, there's no statutory authority for a reunification. However, other than that, pursuant to EDCR 5.65, I believe, the court has the ability to appoint experts, if it so chooses, to assist the court in coming to its decisions, number one. Number two, my client's rights were never terminated. And notwithstanding the fact that a guardianship was deemed necessary, likewise, her relationship with the children is also imperative. And to permit her an opportunity to remain involved with the children and to be able to augment and enhance that relationship is a constitutional right that she has, and it's one that the Ruckels don't enjoy.
Right, and certainly if there had been the petition for termination that she filed had actually gone through the normal process and there's been a hearing, all of that, everybody's rights would have been respected in that process. But instead, we have this so-called removal that sort of sidestepped the normal process.
No, it's not the normal process. Termination and removal are two separate processes.
So why did your client even file a petition to terminate the guardianship then if removal was going to happen?
We didn't know removal was going to happen, but we thought it was appropriate. We filed a petition.
You didn't know either then. Neither side knew.
I certainly didn't receive ex parte communication from the court about what she intended to do, but it certainly the filing of the petition for termination at that point prior to the reunification being completed was done because of the overarching path that was going in this
right.
case.
And that sort of goes back to my original question. Was there some emergency that required this removal versus letting the process play out in the normal way under your petition or a noticed hearing for removal?
Pursuant to the report that the court doesn't have, the education of the children was one of the main issues, and they weren't receiving any.
Wasn't that the slow train that was getting worse that your other counsel referred to? In other words, education isn't good here, bad there. It's a progression. So this is summertime. Why not let the process play out?
Because it would be another year. So here, there was some education going on at mom's house through the public school system. Grandma ostensibly had the children in homeschool, which wasn't being done.
Okay.
Do you have any further questions?
No.
Any further questions?
You referenced the Deegan case. I don't see that in your briefing. What is the case site for that?
The case site for Deegan is Deegan v. Deegan, 37P360, 22 Nevada 185.
I almost am afraid to ask what year it is.
Don't be afraid, Your Honor. It's 1893, and it's solid law.
Okay, thank you. Anything further? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Reynolds?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Have you read that case?
No, Your Honor. I did not see it cited in opposing counsel's briefing. With respect to opposing counsel's suggestion that something was omitted from the appellate record, certainly disagree with that. And I point the court to opposing counsel's own brief on page 20, where they say, admittedly, it does not appear that the reports, referring to Dr. Holland's reports, were lodged in the district court's docket. As this court's aware, pursuant to the NRAPS, appellate counsel cannot submit materials in this court record that were not in the district court record filed below. So disagree with that assertion. And respectfully disagree that there's, or would suggest that there's a misfocus on the reunification therapy and assertions that the Ruckles sought to obstruct it. As cited in our opening brief, the district court initially rejected Ms. Khattab's petition for reunification therapy that she filed. It was only later that the district court ordered it. The Ruckles initially took issue with it because they were ordered to pay $2,000 for the reunification therapy when they were the guardians of their granddaughters, and they were expected to pay for Ms. Khattab's request. Second, they raised some concerns with the district court that Dr. Holland required a blanket waiver of all confidentiality amongst all the participants in reunification therapy. Given their prior history with Ms. Khattab and manipulation, they were concerned about free-flowing communications and no compartmentalization in the reunification therapy process. They raised those concerns with the district court. They ultimately did agree and sign Dr. Holland's engagement. So the suggestion that they've somehow obstructed reunification therapy, we submit, is belied by the record. And I would note this is also in the record. The Ruckles love Ms. Khattab. She is their daughter. They also, though, love their granddaughters. And what they've seen based upon the district court's findings in 2022, that Ms. Khattab failed to provide for their education, their physical well-being, their emotional well-being, was based upon an evidentiary hearing. Before that order is undone by a subsequent district court judge, shouldn't an evidentiary hearing also be held to make factual findings, to have evidence in a record that is challenged, that is vetted, that is not allegations, that is not hearsay, to make the best interest determination?
What about Mr. Smith's argument that this is a removal rather than a termination, therefore it can be an abbreviated procedure the court can do even without notice?
The court, district courts have sua sponte authority. That's recognized by the Nevada Supreme Court in the DMF case, but that's not at odds with due process. They're not mutually exclusive. And because a district court can initiate termination proceedings sua sponte, it doesn't mean that due process is set aside. And to some of your questions, Judge Gibbons, there's no evidence in the record that there is an immediate exigency in this case such that due process can just be put in the wayside. And the Nevada Supreme Court, again, recognized that in the DMF case that we believe is analogous. No notice was properly given here. The Ruckles can't be expected to really read tea leaves that were never communicated to them. No opportunity to be heard was held or given, and we respectfully request that, if I may finish, Chief Judge, respectfully request that this matter be remanded for a full evidentiary hearing where a record can be established for the girls' best interest. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your excellent arguments and insights into the issues before us. We value your participation in today's argument, and we deeply appreciate the attorneys participating in the pro bono program and your willingness to serve Nevadans who need legal representation.